Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you remember when the Berlin Wall fell on November 9, 1989? Amid the euphoria over the end of the Cold War were multiple predictions that the world was entering a period of unprecedented peace and political stability, where without communism to fight, armed conflict was largely obsolete and U.S. intervention would be rare. Many people assumed that was the situation until everything changed on 9/11. But my guest today argues those assumptions don't hold up to closer scrutiny. In fact, new problems emerged throughout the 1990s, and the U.S. military engaged in foreign interventions about every year and a half, far more frequently than it had in the decades preceding. The time between 11/9 and 9/11 was also extraordinary in the way it created unexpected allies, like isolationist conservatives and anti-war liberals, or liberal hawks and neocons, both dedicated to spreading American democratic ideals to places where they did not exist naturally. Derek Chollet's new book, co-written with James Goldgeier, explores this remarkable period in world and U.S. history. Chollet is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and the book is called America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11, the misunderstood years between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the start of the War on Terror. Derek, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
People tend to look at the 90s as either this decade when we sort of squandered our chances to get the upper hand on security before the terrorists came along, or they'll look at it as a golden age when we had a booming economy and we had hyperpower status in terms of geopolitical influence for the U.S. Why can't we agree that it might have been both?
Well, I think in many ways it was both. And I think one of the things, one of the reasons we wrote this book is that this history of the 90s, of the or the years 1989 to 2001, is very much contested. And for example, President Bush, the current president, in his second inaugural address in 2005, called these the years of sabbatical, the years of repose. And this was an effort to sort of, as a matter of history, to try to frame these years as sort of a wasted period of time. But then it's interesting, of course. Hillary Clinton, in her campaign for president earlier this year, promised that if she were to get the nomination and win, she would bring the 1990s back. So in many ways, it's instructive that both sides of the political aisle are trying to sort of frame these years in a way that works to their advantage.
Well, you make it clear in the book that Republicans and Democrats both needed to really redefine themselves after the wall fell. And for Republicans in particular, there was a sort of vacuum to fill because they no longer had communism as this shared threat. Can you talk about how that played itself out in policymaking?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the end of the Cold War in 1989 was sort of an ironic moment for Republicans and conservatives. In many ways, it was seen as a huge triumph for conservatism, right? I mean, Ronald Reagan, by their measure, was in large part responsible for ending the Cold War. And but yet, when the Cold War ends in this triumph, they were sort of set adrift in a way, where conservatives sort of were divided among themselves. Anti-communism had been the glue that had held conservatism together. And without the Soviet Union and communism to sort of unify conservatives, they began to splinter in different ways. And you saw this, say, for example, in the 92 campaign, where George H.W. Bush, who was very much an internationalist and someone who believed in institutions like the United Nations, had a very strong primary opponent with Pat Buchanan, who had a much different message, more of a neo-isolationist, nativist, nationalist message, who, in fact, campaigned in 1992 and did quite well against the sitting president, arguing that the Bush 41 spent too much time caring about the world and didn't care enough about problems at home.
What were the rules that we all sort of agreed on for military engagement during the Cold War?
Well, obviously any use of the U.S. military is highly contested and controversial, right? I mean, I think there is a sort of false nostalgia for the Cold War as though all decisions were easy then. Of course, we had military interventions during the Cold War that were quite controversial. Vietnam, the Grenada invasion, whatnot. So, but I think what happened during the 1990s is that there was a sense that first military intervention would be less frequent because so many of our interventions throughout the Cold War were motivated by fighting the Soviets, fighting communism. And secondly, that even if it were to happen, it would be relatively easy because our foes were not going to be the, great evil empire. And when, in fact, the opposite happened, and that's sort of one of the ironies of the period, and I think it's a legacy we're still living with today. Military intervention, in many ways, did not sort of cease in frequency at all. In fact, if anything, you could argue it got we did more interventions during this period than we ever had before in our history. And it was a lot more complicated because these weren't the simple battles. They were fights and efforts that were more akin to what we are facing today in Iraq and Afghanistan, failed and failing states, military operations that are beyond just going out and killing the bad guys, but helping societies uplift themselves and helping people get on their feet, what was called nation building. And, of course, when President Bush ran for office in 2000, nation building was something that he and his campaign derided. But, of course, we're now involved in two of the greatest nation building efforts in our history.
Another thing that happened right after the Cold War ended was that there was a sort of, I don't know whether you agree it was revisionist history, but many people turned around and said, you know, the Soviets were never as dangerous as we thought they were, based on the fact that everything sort of ended peacefully.
Right.
Do you think there's a potential that the situation we're in now could end in a similar way if we are, in fact, able to come out of this on the other side in a relatively stable world? Will we look back at the current period and think that?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, of course, the enemy of today is not, or they are not the Soviets in that they are not a state, they are a stateless enemy. And it's a terrorist organization. And what's happening is, I think you saw in the months and years after 9/11 an effort to make the war on terror as a sort of framework for U.S. foreign policy, similar to what containment was during the Cold War. All right. One of the stories that we detail in the book, America Between the Wars, is that the struggle after containment is over is to define what the New World was about and what America's role should be in it, and to find if there was going to be a replacement for containment. And, of course, we failed during these years to find a replacement for containment. 9/11 happens, and there was an effort, certainly by the administration, but many in the foreign policy world, to say the war on terror is the new containment. And what we're seeing today is the war on terror as a framework for foreign policy becoming certainly less popular, more controversial, and in some ways discredited, because even the leading military thinkers and officers will tell you that war is not necessarily the right way to think about the fight against Islamic extremism, because it's not only a military, there's no military solution alone. It requires other things that the military is not best equipped for. So, you know, I think we could look back and say, you know, it's the war on terror was not the way to think of it. In fact, when we interviewed Colin Powell for this book, he said to us quite clearly, it's not a war on terror. We shouldn't call it that. It's a criminal problem. This isn't the equivalent of the Soviet Union. That does not diminish at all the level of threat and the intent of those who wish to do us harm, but it sort of changes the way we should maybe think about combating that.
I'm glad you brought up Colin Powell because, you know, we've heard so much analysis since the start of the war in Iraq about the battle for dominance in the cabinet between the State Department and the Defense Department. But this also is really nothing new, according to your analysis. Those forces were very much at work in the George H.W. Bush administration.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what we try to show in this book how that many of the arguments that were going on among Republicans and among Democrats in the days and months and years after 9/11 were very much a continuation of the arguments that had been going on since 11/9, since the fall of the Berlin Wall on November 9th, 1989. And we see that some of these dividing lines that, you know, have been, you know, very much discussed in the last 7 years under George W. Bush, that the dividing lines among Republicans did indeed go back to these early, the first Bush administration, in fact. And, I mean, our argument would be that if George H.W. Bush had actually won re-election in 1992, these fights would have played out in a second Bush administration in the early 90s. And what would have been interesting is to see sort of how they would have adjudicated these differences then, because they did exist then. I think the Clinton years cloaked these differences in many ways because, in some ways, anti-Clintonism became a unifying force on the right. But then the differences were there and were greatly fought over during the George W. Bush years.
Derek Chollet is my guest. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His book is called America Between the Wars. Bill Clinton, of course, was the longest serving U.S. president during this approximately 12-year period. And he actually moved in a fairly aggressive direction in terms of openness to the use of U.S. force.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting about the trajectory of the Clinton presidency, which, you know, we deal with quite a bit in this book, is, you know, how President Clinton starts off and he lacks confidence in terms of foreign policy. There's a view that perhaps foreign policy matters less and national security matters less because of the end of the Cold War and attention can be turned to problems at home. And Clinton's presidency was in many ways defined by early missteps that he had in Bosnia and inability to solve the war in Bosnia, in Somalia and the tragic Black Hawk Down incident of October 1993, in Haiti, in which there were sort of interventions that were sort of messy and not very well done, and in Rwanda, the non-intervention in Rwanda, of course, when 800,000 people were killed in 100 days in 1994. And although Clinton, over time, got much more confident with the use of force, and I think we saw that play out, say, towards the end of his administration in 1999 in the Kosovo War, the sort of image of the Clinton administration that had been set by those early missteps and disasters. But Clinton himself and the Democratic Party generally became much more confident in the use of the military, and I think we're frankly very effective in how they use the military towards the end of his administration.
He was willing to move without a great deal of multilateral support in some cases.
Right. I mean, and I think that's one of the things that often gets overlooked, given how controversial this so-called U.S. unilateralism has been in the last 7 years under President Bush. I mean, Bill Clinton tried very hard, say, for example, in Kosovo in 1999, to get U.N. Security Council authorization for the use of force there. Was unable to do so because of Russia and China's opposition, so used the NATO alliance. And so it was a multilateral effort. It was not with UN authorization, which upset many people at home and around the world. But I think there was a sort of important distinction between Clinton's approach to multilateralism and, say, for example, the current administration's approach, particularly early. I mean, for Clinton, it was really trying to get a multilateral solution and going alone only if we have to, whereas I think for the current administration, the going in position was to do it alone and do it with others only if you have to. So it was a little there's a fine distinction there.
So avoid being tied down essentially in the
Absolutely.
Second case.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the factions of the Democratic Party during this time with regard to foreign policy and how we should conduct ourselves?
Right. Bill Clinton had a very sort of forward-leaning view of the world. Of course, he campaigned for president in 1992, talking about how, for example, the global economy should be a more important part of foreign policy, talking a lot about democracy promotion and the importance of having a foreign policy that was rooted in values and promoting those values around the world, and on the use of force and sort of saying that the U.S. had a role in solving problems around the world. And that was in many ways a Clinton consensus that he campaigned on in 92 and over throughout his presidency worked very hard to sort of build a set of policies around. That was not the consensus was not sort of universally held on the left. Of course, for example, on the trade agenda, I mean, trade was and remains one of the more divisive issues on the left among Democrats. Clinton tried very hard during his presidency to pass trade agreements, the NAFTA agreement being one of the more prominent. And he did so with a lot of opposition on the left. And I think what's interesting is, just because Clinton was president, there was a sense that maybe the Democratic Party was more unified around these issues than it really was. And I think what Jim and I try to do in this book is show how a lot of the divisions and fights we've seen emerge on the left under the George W. Bush years are fights that were going on during the Clinton years, but were kind of obscured or overwhelmed by the larger fight between Republicans and Democrats.
The book is called America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11, The Misunderstood Years Between the Fall of the Berlin Wall and the Start of the War on Terror. My guest this afternoon is one of the co-authors, Derek Chollet. He's a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. We will return to our conversation in a moment. If you want to get on the line to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we will talk about how the emergence of non-state actors in our foreign policy decision-making has changed the way we do things.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Derek Chollet. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His new book is called America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Derek, clearly terrorism did not emerge on 9/11, even for the United States. But I want to know how much of the sort of planning for national defense acts of terrorism were before the Berlin Wall fell, if at all.
Well, you're right. I mean, terrorism was not something that's simply a 9/11 and to the present phenomenon. I mean, of course, we had been dealing with terrorism as a country, you know, all the way back into the 80s, right? With 1983, the Marine barracks were bombed in Beirut. And there was a series of terrorist incidents all the way through the 80s, up until, you know, in 1989 and after. But I think it wasn't really until the mid-1990s that, you know, the national security institutions and the Clinton administration started to focus on a particular terrorist group, Al-Qaeda. And, you know, I think it's what's interesting to us is inside the Clinton administration, you saw many officials, and including the president, who understood the terrorist threat, who were seized with it and seeking to try to find a way to fight it. But it was a struggle, definitely. And, you know, President Clinton several times used force in Afghanistan, you know, cruise missile attacks in an attempt to take out bin Laden prior to 2001. And, of course, the history of kind of the handoff between Clinton and the current president on Al-Qaeda and sort of, you know, the level of attention that the new administration gave to the issue in 2001 has been well covered, the 9/11 Commission report and elsewhere.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Derek Chollet. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and the book is called America Between the Wars. You know, if the Clinton White House was, in fact, sort of well aware of the threat from Al-Qaeda, and if there was an attack not long after the Clinton presidency ended, is it fair for the Bush administration to characterize the real failure to have been on the part of the Clinton White House?
No. I mean, I think look, there are many reasons why the 9/11 attacks occurred, and I think one of the great sort of historical arguments that will go forward is whether or not, you know, had Clinton still been in office or had Al Gore won the election in 2000, whether or not there would have been a chance to prevent it or whether the plot was too far along by that point to make much of a difference. I mean, I think what we do know that is undeniable and our book, you know, details is that when the new team comes into office in 2001, when the Bush team comes into office, terrorism was not high on the list. I mean, I think it's sort of undeniable. I mean, the president himself has admitted that. In retrospect. And what's interesting, and this is sort of reflective of the debate about foreign policy during the 1990s, conservatives in general were not focused on terrorism and the Al-Qaeda threat throughout the 1990s. They were more focused on more traditional sort of state-centric threats, for example, the rise of China, things like missile defense. And, you know, it was not something that they saw as a high priority. Now, 9/11 clearly changed that. I mean, that was something where all of us, I think it was more of a wake-up call to the current trends in politics rather than an example of sort of a turning point fundamentally in terms of the globe. But, you know, I think there'll be a healthy blame game for many, 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 many years on this subject. What we try to do in our book is to sort of shed some light on some of the underlying trends that influence both conservatives and liberals on the terror threat throughout the 1990s up until 2001.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Lorraine in Dallas. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I would like to ask your guest about a current situation that is being reported widely in Europe and is being characterized as a potential new Cold War, which is the situation in the Czech Republic and Poland with the U.S. proposed bases and the very public statements Russia has made that if the plans go forward, that they will realign their missiles. And that's my question.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. I mean, the missile defense, and that's, of course, you're talking about U.S. missile defense facilities on the soil of Poland and the Czech Republic. You know, missile defense is one of those issues that, with the end of the Cold War in 1989, it went away for several years. I mean, it was, of course, a huge issue during the Reagan administration in the 80s at the height of the Cold War. Soviet Union goes away, and there's sort of the rationale for missile defense, of course, seems to go away with it. By the end of the 90s and the emergence of threats like North Korea missile threat, an Iranian missile threat, an Iraqi missile threat, there was a sense that we needed to look into something like missile defense. And, you know, I think the Bush administration, although it probably had higher hopes for what it wanted to achieve in terms of missile defense, it has still pursued this policy. And as the caller points out, one of the problems or sort of the challenges we face in sort of implementing missile defense is how you do so in a way that keeps the Russians, who of course still have thousands of nuclear weapons, many of which are still targeted at us, as are ours at them, from this sort of becoming a crisis with Russia. And I mean, my personal view is that I think, you know, the missile defense installations that we're talking about putting into the Czech Republic and Poland would do absolutely nothing to affect the Russian arsenal. They would be basically ineffective against Russia. So it's sort of an issue that the Russians are using for their political advantage. That said, I think we have to be more sensitive in how we are going about pursuing this, just because we don't need yet another issue to upset the balance between us and Russia.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Derek Chollet, a co-author of the book America Between the Wars from 11-9 to 9-11. Let's go next to Shrimi Bossum in Dallas. Hi, Shrimi Bossum.
Hi. Very interesting conversation. Thank you very much. And I have a question for your guest.
Okay.
I would like him to enlighten us on the role of media. The case and example is the Iraq War, when the media stopped asking hard questions. And then there was a lot of introspection on what went wrong. And when you look at the current presidential elections, they're doing the same thing, not asking hard questions to Barack Obama, for instance, and they seem to be going back to the old habits. So what is the media playing? Why is the media not playing an effective role?
Thanks for your call.
Interesting question. I mean, there's no doubt that from the Cold War, really until 9/11, media coverage of global affairs generally dropped off. And I think that was a problem. And many journalists and people in the media industry were very worried about this. I mean, many foreign news bureaus were closed. There was just less airtime given to international affairs generally. And I think that did sort of set a national mood where we talked less about the world than we should have been. I mean, I think clearly in the wake of 9/11, that has changed quite a bit, where media coverage has on foreign news has gone up quite a bit. In terms of kind of the media questioning our leaders and politicians, having worked in the government and having worked on campaigns, I guess I have a different view. I mean, I think the media, although the coverage, you know, had dropped off in the 90s, I think the media is a fairly aggressive and thoughtful critic. They could, you know, you can always point to examples where they mess up just as policymakers, but it seems to me that there is a healthy dialogue. In fact, if anything, given the proliferation of media outlets with blogs and online news, online video, there's even more to answer to if you're a policymaker or a politician. So we need to have a strong media. We need to have a media that is asking questions. And I think all of us, frankly, learned a very tough lesson in the lead up to the Iraq War, where I think there's a lot of blame to go around on how that story was handled in the year 2002 and 2003 in the lead up to the war.
You point out that Bill Clinton had new kinds of issues to deal with as president that his predecessors simply did not, including the forces of a truly global economy.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that affected his presidency?
Well, it was a huge challenge, not just on the substance of the issues, because it was sort of harder to put these issues in a particular box. There were so many overlapping questions. But it was also hard on the politics, because it was, you know, the global economy doesn't just change American foreign policy. It changes our economy here at home as jobs move overseas or workers need to be trained in different ways to be able to compete with, you know, folks in other countries. And I think what we give Clinton a lot of credit for in this book is that he understood globalization, and he sought throughout his presidency to try to discuss it with the American people. It's very striking if you go back and read all of Clinton's speeches during his presidency, how often he talked about globalization and tried to kind of explain its complexities and opportunities and challenges. And I think, you know, looking back, you could say he had some success at that, probably not as much as he had hoped, probably not as much as we all probably needed. And I think going forward, this is a conversation that's going to continue, and the next president, whether it's McCain or Obama, is going to have to continue to sort of prepare Americans for this changing world in which, you know, the global chessboard is transforming right before us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Galen in Fort Worth. Hi, Galen.
Hi there. This is a great conversation, by the way. I really enjoy listening to it. And this may be a little outside the scope of your book, but I had a question about what you think the influence of the military-industrial complex on, say, the Bush administration or any administration, and how that impacts our desire to go to war or our willingness to do so.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and obviously a question that comes up quite a bit whenever you talk about any sort of military engagement. We do talk about it a bit in this book because, of course, the years that we cover, these years between the wars, so to speak, between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the war on terror on 9/11, were years in which the phrase peace dividend was much discussed around the country, where there was a sense that with the Cold War over, you could spend less money on the military, less money on things like intelligence, and therefore have more to spend on domestic needs. And to a certain extent, there was a surely a reduction in the defense budget. I mean, to be fair, George H.W. Bush in the early 90s and Dick Cheney, who was his defense secretary, laid out plans for a reduction in the defense budget in the out years after they left office. But what we also uncover is one of the sort of some of the tragic consequences of that. I mean, take, for example, in the intelligence side, our intelligence community was put under huge financial stress during the 1990s. It was seen as a place where a lot of cuts could have been made. We interviewed many former senior intelligence officials who said that it was sort of the irony of it is as the world was becoming more complex and the sort of you had to worry about situations in the Balkans or Haiti or Africa, places that we hadn't thought much about during the Cold War, the money and the resources to understand those places actually went down. So John McLaughlin, who was during the Bush years was a director of the CIA, said to us that, you know, the CIA and the intelligence community went from Chapter 11 to 9/11. And, you know, it did leave us ill-prepared, leave us as a country ill-prepared to sort of understand these new threats. And we've been playing catch-up ever since.
Was there, during the Clinton administration, an effort to move intelligence in a different direction from the, you know, it's been cut back sort of significantly throughout the George H.W. Bush years? Did intelligence change during the Clinton administration, or was that one of the things that sort of held static during his presidency?
Well, no, it did change. I mean, it changed first for the reason we were just discussing, which is it had to try to figure out how to do more with less, which was, you know, forced it to change in many ways. It also had to then begin sort of understand these new threats as they were emerging. Now, one of the interesting things that the intelligence community spent time focusing on was things like trade negotiations. Again, there was a sense that economic issues, global economic issues, were going to be more central to the foreign policy agenda. And so there were more intelligence resources were placed on, instead of understanding how many tanks a country like the Soviet Union would have, understanding kind of how the impact of currency manipulation and how markets overseas could affect markets here at home. But then also, of course, Islamic extremism, Al-Qaeda, and the intelligence community created its Bin Laden unit, a sort of special core of intelligence analysts and operatives to understand Bin Laden in the mid-1990s.
Would you talk for a minute about ethnic cleansing? Because that's also a term that, although, again, the scourge of that has existed for a long time in human history, it was something that came into a different sort of focus throughout the 90s.
Yeah, there was a sense that where, you know, the world had been divided largely during the Cold War between the West and the East, right, between the United States and its allies and the Soviets and its allies or satellites. And that because of that, a lot of these, the sort of the complex ethnic tapestry that were many, you know, many countries in which there were different rival ethnic groups, that had been sort of put under wraps, in a sense, by the Cold War. And the Cold War ends, and a lot of these tensions and rivalries and arguments become uncorked. And they become uncorked not because of sort of natural reasons, but because leaders, cynical leaders, actually tried to play on these differences and tensions to exploit them for their own purposes. We saw that, of course, unfold in the former Yugoslavia, which, you know, it breaks apart and explodes into several civil wars that end up occupying a tremendous amount of time for the United States as we try to think about, find a way to bring peace to that place. So, you know, it goes to this question, which actually we're still facing right now in Iraq, where you have an ethnically complex country with overlapping ethnic groups, with different sort of loyalties, with extreme violence, and, you know, so-called mixed neighborhoods, neighborhoods in which different ethnic groups have lived together. There's a sense that people are either leaving those neighborhoods because they feel unsafe, or there's an active effort to kick people out. And that's really where the phrase ethnic cleansing came from. And it sort of was a phrase that was coined in the Balkans in the early 1990s.
Have the balance has shifted? You know, before you had people who were isolationists sort of for self-preservation reasons and the reasons that it's just not our job to deal with the rest of the world. And then you had people who didn't want to engage in war as a matter of principle.
Right.
Are the balances between people on the left and on the right sort of shifting given the new reality and what we've seen happen, especially in places like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing this strain of isolationism sort of come roaring back a little bit now. I mean, it shouldn't be overstated in that, you know, of course, say the candidates just who ran for president this past time who were most associated with isolationist positions, for example, Texas's own Ron Paul on the right and say a Dennis Kucinich on the left, they were unsuccessful. You know, they had a loyal following, but it was a small loyal following. But I think particularly given the tremendous costs, you know, our men and women in uniform have paid, we as a country have paid. There is I think there's more traction in the body politic to the idea that we should be less interventionist in the world, take on less problems. But I think what we try to show in this book is the challenge of kind of calibrating America's power and huge potential with the tremendous problems that are out there in the globe that really
back in just a minute with Derek Schiller. Hold on, Derek. 1 minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Derek Schiller. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His book is called America Between the Wars. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And Derek, I apologize for interrupting you with that break, but you were talking about the sort of postmodern enthusiasm for a new form of isolationism in this country.
Right, and I think that there is a sense that given the tremendous costs that we have incurred as a country, our men and women in uniform serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, that America should be less engaged in the world. I don't want to overstate that trend. I think, you know, as we saw during the campaign this past election, you know, in the primaries, neither Ron Paul on the right or Dennis Kucinich on the left got very far with their campaigns. Nevertheless, it is there. And I think what we try to do in this book is show how the struggle that we were facing as a country between the wars from 11/9 to 9/11, the fall of the wall to the fall of the towers, is a struggle that we're still facing today in terms of how we reconcile America's huge power, huge potential, and ability to solve problems with challenges we have here at home, as well as how you balance, you know, what we're doing in one place in the world with our interests in another place in the world. And it's not easy to do, and I think the next president, whether it's McCain or Obama, this will be one of the great challenges that he's going to face.
Well, to what extent do Senators McCain and Obama represent sort of the core of each party's factions, I guess, in terms of foreign policy and isolationism versus interventionism?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think first it should be known that said that there is actually less difference between McCain and Obama on foreign policy issues than there would have been, say, for example, Obama and Giuliani or Obama and Romney. I mean, McCain, throughout his Senate career, has sort of struck a very sort of centrist tone in his foreign policy. And what's interesting on the Republican side is you see these factions that really emerged with the end of the Cold War between, you know, neoconservative hawks and more kind of traditional foreign policy realists like a George H.W. Bush, with even some Buchananite kind of neo-isolationists, all under the McCain tent. And it's an unruly tent. It's one that where these factions are fighting with one another, and we've seen that already play out in the campaign. Obama, on his core foreign policy issues, actually, you know, is reflective of the consensus that was in the Democratic Party when Bill Clinton and Al Gore left office in 2001. He is, you know, open to trade deals and believes in a global economy. He believes in promoting values and democracy. He believes in using force when necessary. And I think the challenge for Obama is going to be more of a political one, because I think there's, because of particularly some of the identification that some of those issues have with George W. Bush, for example, democracy promotion and the controversy that arouses on the left, that will be a challenge for Obama, both in the campaign and then as president.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Pim in Dallas. Hi, Pim.
Hello. I have a question for the guest, please.
Okay.
Does the guest recall President Bush, soon after he came into office and previous to 9/11, making a trip to Spain? And if so, wasn't part of his agenda there about terrorism? I'll take it off there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I don't remember him, whether or not he made a trip to Spain prior to 9/11. Of course, in the days after 9/11, Spain and the president of Spain at the time were one of the few real allies the Bush administration found, particularly in the lead-up to the Iraq War, where it was Spain and Tony Blair led Great Britain. But I think one of the things that we've seen, you know, throughout the Bush presidency, that again is also somewhat of a continuation of the struggles we had during the 1990s, that we detail in this book, is, you know, the essential but yet difficult relationship that we have with some of our European friends. It's the most important set of relations we have, but it's not easy, and it's one that needs to be constantly managed. I think the Bush administration has learned some lessons of its own. I mean, it came into office with probably a more cavalier attitude towards European allies, believing, you know, there was a lot of sort of probably, in retrospect, irresponsible talk about old Europe versus new Europe and whether or not we needed those alliances. And I think you've seen, actually, in the last few years, the Bush administration getting along quite well with Europe, and European leaders in France and Britain and Germany looking to get along well with the United States. And I think that will continue in 2009 and beyond, whether it's a President Obama or President McCain.
The two presidents that will precede the next one, in other words, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, were, you know, governors of southern states when they came into office. They didn't really have any foreign policy experience whatsoever. When you look at the two candidates that we have now, it would appear that John McCain has much more familiarity based on his tenure in the Senate than Barack Obama. Will that hurt Obama's chances?
I don't think so. It's interesting. This, so far in this campaign, both candidates are talking a lot about national security, and they both feel that their positions on national security are the winning positions, not just in terms of a policy argument, but for politics as well. And you know, what I think is interesting about this next election, and I'm hopeful, and this goes to the question of their ability to govern, is both Bill Clinton's election in 1992 and George W. Bush's election in 2000 were both seen by the losing side as illegitimate. Bill Clinton won in 1992 with only 43% of the electoral vote. Many Republicans believed he only won because Ross Perot had been a candidate and taken 19% of the vote. And so they almost saw his presidency as illegitimate, and therefore anything he did as president as sort of not serious or not something that they had to buy into. Similarly, Democrats looked at the outcome of the 2000 election and the Supreme Court decision in December of 2000 and saw a similar problem at work, George W. Bush being elected sort of illegitimately, and therefore something, you know, he was someone who they felt like they didn't need to cooperate with. And I think my hope is that the next president, whether it is a President Obama or President McCain, we have a president who wins decisively enough that the losing side, although disappointed, believes that this person was legitimately elected. And I think that could actually itself go a long way to that president's ability to forge a consensus on not just foreign policy, but domestic policy as well.
Luke in Norman, Oklahoma, writes an email to ask what your thoughts are about the impeachment and how it may have tied the hands of President Clinton. He says, if Mr. Clinton had put an all-out offensive toward al-Qaeda, would Republicans have cried Clinton is trying to draw focus away from the impeachment?
Yeah, this is something we deal with quite a bit in the book. Of course, during, you know, one of the great tragedies of history is as the Clinton administration was dealing with al-Qaeda and particularly the reaction to the bombings, the simultaneous bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa in August of 1998, the president and his political team and lawyers were also dealing with the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And there were accusations, even to the extent Clinton did anything against al-Qaeda, you know, for example, the cruise missile attacks against Afghanistan in August of 98, there were cries by Republican opponents that it was a wag the dog phenomenon. Wag the dog was a popular movie at the time in which it depicts a president drumming up a war in order to deflect attention from other problems. And we recount in the book, actually, you know, Bill Clinton in August of 1998, when he's on vacation in Martha's Vineyard, you know, simultaneously dealing with how to respond to the embassy bombings and planning for a military strike, with meeting and huddling with his lawyers to deal with the coming impeachment fight. So, you know, I think there's no doubt that it certainly distracted a tremendous amount of public attention away, the impeachment battle, that is, public attention away from problems like the rise of Islamic extremism. And I, you know, since we already know that Clinton's political opponents were using the issue against him to criticize his use of force in Afghanistan, for example, I would assume that had he done more, that outcry would have been even greater.
Do you assume that if things were going swimmingly in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the tide of American sentiment on both the left and the right would have moved far toward interventionism?
I don't assume that. I mean, I guess I think that people still believe that America has a vital role to play in the world. And I think the fact is we have two presidential candidates who both represent that worldview. But I do think it's true that moving forward, there will be greater skepticism about the use of force. That's not necessarily a bad thing, of course. You know, as one of the earlier callers alluded to, it probably would have been better had we had more skepticism in the lead-up to the Iraq War about the use of force. But I do think that you know, as a country, we still understand the paradox of American power, which is whereas we are the most powerful country in the world, you know, despite the rise of China and rise of India, we're still more powerful. But the paradox is we cannot solve any problem alone. So the challenge we face as a country that we try to detail in this book is as a story, a larger story than just the George W. Bush years. It's a story that really begins with the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, is how we deploy our power in a way that brings as many countries as our side as possible, but without sort of constraining what we see as our core vital national interests.
So you write about the fact that things did not change as much on 9/11 as many of us believe, because most of the same problems existed before the attacks. Is there some sort of danger in people believing that 9/11 was more than an emotional turning point?
Well, I mean, first, 9/11 is an important date. It will always be an important date for our country. I mean, it will go up with December 7th, 1941, the Pearl Harbor attack, and as, you know, one of the great and tragic moments we face as a nation. And of course, 9/11 for the families of those who were lost, well, of course everything changed on that day. But our point is that the underlying trends of global politics and the struggle of America, of defining America's role in the world, did not change on 9/11. And I think what we've seen in the wake of 9/11, and this gets to your point about maybe one of the dangers of it, is an effort to frame all of America's problems in the world and our role in the world with three simple words: war on terror. And I think that has been to sort of try to shoehorn everything we face into that sort of bumper sticker, the way we tried to we shoehorned everything during the Cold War under the bumper sticker of containment, has negative effects. And I think there's greater recognition now among military folks, national security analysts, politicians, and common citizens that whereas, you know, there are terrorists out there who mean to do us harm and we need to be strong to be able to fight them, there's more to global politics and more to the future than just that.
The nice thing about the end of the Cold War was that there was a sort of definitive date. You know, you can look at November 9th and think, okay, that was the day when we can sort of call it the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we're relatively successful in prevailing against terrorist attacks, there won't be, it's more like a chronic illness that might flare up at any moment. I'm wondering if there's something that we can take, though, from that 12-year period of relative calm and what happened then and the right and wrong decisions that were made. Can we take something from that to apply to the next period in between major conflicts for this country?
Well, you're absolutely right that there's no end date necessary for the war on terror. There's not going to be the treaty signing, you know, on the battleship, as even Don Rumsfeld himself has admitted. I mean, it seems to me that one of the great lessons we can draw from these years, the 1990s, is that America is a great country that that has enormous potential to do very good things, but it is a resource, our power is a resource that constantly needs to be husbanded and managed well, and that with the right kind of leadership, we can actually be very successful in the world. It doesn't mean that there are not going to be problems. It doesn't mean there are not going to be difficulties. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be decisions that we make that make other people unhappy with us. But I think, you know, with perhaps greater humility, with a willingness to compromise on certain things, and with an ability to sort of really try to bring the American people along with this argument, to sort of not seek to control everything, but to make this a national conversation about what the future holds. We have a chance to be successful, and we were successful in many ways in the 90s.
Were you and your partner in this book, Jim Goldgeier, were you taken by surprise when you sat down to sort of put these conclusions together at how many similarities there were between particular actions that were taken during the Clinton administration as opposed to the George W. Bush administration?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the startling things for us were the continuities. I think it's become kind of convenient almost for people to say, well, the 90s were either everything was good or everything was just kind of adrift, and then 9/11 happened, and history began on 9/11. And for depending on what side of the political aisle you're on, either everything's been good or everything's been bad ever since then. And I think what opened our eyes in this book, and we hope that readers will also sort of respond to, is how this is a greater challenge than just sort of a 9/11 to today challenge. That these are problems, you know, America's role in the world, what to do with our great power, how to handle really difficult problems that don't know single borders or single states like Islamic extremism, how to deal with the global economy, weapons proliferation. These are problems that are still manifestations of the end of the Cold War. And we can learn a lot from sort of trying to take off our sort of political or partisan eyeglasses and trying to take a cold, hard look at this history, which is what we try to do in this book.
Derek Chollet is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. His new book is called America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11, the misunderstood years of between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the start of the War on Terror. Derek, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.